It's the Burt Cohen Show. What a dream it is, all different angles and factions, different fighting going on down in Washington right now as we reach the middle of October. And the word anarchy has been thrown around a little bit, but what is anarchy? We all know the caricature of the anarchist, the black cape, the hidden faced bomb thrower. That's the caricature of the anarchist, but it's hardly the reality. There's a lot more to it. It's a long intellectual, philosophical tradition in the United States and in the Western world in general. And we're going to talk about clarifying what anarchism really is. Does it apply these days or doesn't it? Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid recently derided his opponents as Tea Party anarchists. Elizabeth Warren also referred to the right-wing Republicans holding the government hostage as the anarchy gang. Well, I'm very pleased to have with us today on the Burt Cohen Show, Nathan Schneider. Nathan, thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be on the show. Thanks for taking up this important question.
Well, I'm happy to do so. I'd love to clear up falsehoods that are often thrown out there. We have a society that, frankly, isn't all that aware of history, to put it mildly, and I'd love to clarify things so that people can have the tools they need to really be able to participate. Nathan Schneider writes about religion, reason, and violence for publications including The Nation, The New York Times, The Boston Globe, Commonweal, Religion Dispatches, Alternet, and others. He's also editor at Killing the Buddha, and his website is theroboat.com. We'll have to ask about that toward the end of the show. Well, as I mentioned, Reid and Elizabeth Warren are calling the right-wing Republicans the seditious Republicans, really. If you look up definition of the word sedition, there it is. But how off the mark are they, or are they off the mark at all, when they call those who hold America hostage anarchists? Do anarchists not now rejoice at the apparent self-destruction of the United States government?
Well, it's interesting. You know, what's kind of surprising is that a lot of people who would describe themselves actually as anarchists proudly are not necessarily rejoicing right now. And part of the reason is that the kind of shutdown that we're experiencing is one that really reflects the backwards priorities in their view, of U.S. society and politics, where a lot of the services that go to the most vulnerable people are being cut, while a lot of the security services and the things about government that anarchists are really concerned about remain very much intact. But there is a sense in which I think the term is accurate, and that is that the kind of libertarian right that in some ways informs the Tea Party right now does share common ancestry, intellectual traditions with people who call themselves anarchists. This goes back centuries to the Enlightenment. They share a lot of the same kind of common forefathers, but there's been a kind of diversion where the people who call themselves libertarians now are really just concerned about government oppression. They're not concerned about all kinds of other things, most notably corporate and economic oppression. They seem unconcerned about that, whereas anarchists, people who call themselves anarchists, are deeply concerned about that right now.
If you just tuned in, our guest is Nathan Schneider, who writes about religion, reason, violence for many different national publications. We're talking about anarchism, anarchy. You know, people get the sense that the word chaos and anarchy are interchangeable. What about that? Is that accurate?
Well, I think it can be in some ways, you know, and there's some way in which anarchists have been associated with a longing for a kind of chaotic moment. But I think much more, and especially when you look back to the origins of this tradition and for much of its history, anarchists have been actually most concerned with creating an even better organized society. The difference is that they're concerned to see organization happen from the ground up, horizontally rather than vertically, so that organization doesn't necessarily come from some people having power over others, but everyone being free and making decisions for themselves in a truly democratic way. So in their view, for a lot of anarchists, they see the kind of society they're longing for as less chaotic and more ordered, better ordered than what we've got.
Interesting. So horizontally, what does that look like? Right now, certainly we have a vertical structure, which has existed throughout, well, at least Western history for a couple thousand years or so, maybe more than that. We have the powerful few, and the people without power, the many. And that has been an order that has functioned. Whether it's been moral or not is another question, but it has functioned reasonably well. In the military, you certainly don't have a horizontal structure. You have to have commanders. People have to follow the leaders and respect the leaders and do what they say. Otherwise, society falls apart. Now, you know, you couldn't have a military action on a horizontal basis, or could you? What do you think about that particular example?
Well, there have been examples of moments where people have tried to organize military structures along more horizontal lines, such as during the Spanish Civil War when anarchists were one of the fronts confronting fascism, and they were able to operate military units along anarchist lines, roughly horizontal, where the decision-making structure was a little more spread out, and the lines between officers and everyone else were a little less strong. I think it's important to recognize that this is not this should be what we're all after to begin with. It's just shocking to me that so many of us claim we live in a democracy, yet we have seemingly no interest in, for instance, democratizing our economy, in ensuring that the corporate structures in which most of us spend much of our time, that we get all of our goods from, are not run according to democratic principles, where workers aren't don't have control over the things that they produce, where people who purchase things don't have any control about how they're produced. And there are structures in place for how to do this. There are examples. Worker-owned co-ops are an excellent example and a very widespread example, though not widespread enough, of how you can organize the economy differently. And really, it's shocking to me that more of us don't demand this, don't demand that our workplaces are governed according to the same ideals that we at least aspire to see our government organized according to.
And I think one could say, show examples of where the hierarchical structure in manufacturing has produced results that have been really, really harmful for us all. I look at one of the biggest sectors in the American economy, aside from the war machine, there is producing automobiles out of Detroit. And frankly, some of the cars, many of the cars that came out in the 70s, 80s, were not really good. And the car industry tanked, and it had to be bailed out. And part of the reason, I think, is because the people who were on the lines who make the cars had no ability whatsoever to participate in the decision-making process. It was all, the decisions were made top down. The owners of the company, people sitting around the board table being paid giant salaries, were making all the decisions. And had the workers been able to participate in what kind of cars there were, they might have been better cars and better able to compete. And it does seem that workers lately, at least in the auto industry, have been able to participate more and save the money. Economic democracy, is economic democracy one and the same as the concept of anarchism, or is it a subgroup of the general umbrella of anarchism?
Well, it's often something that's associated with anarchist thought, but it's not solely, it's not just associated with anarchy. This concept of economic democracy is actually has popularity on the American right as well as on the left. Republicans in many jurisdictions have supported legislation to encourage worker-owned co-ops. They too see this as in line with the dream of American ownership and creating a society where everybody is able to, in some sense, own what they produce and build wealth for their families and so forth off of it. And so it's something that anarchists are very interested in because it's more democratic, it's more kind of local, it doesn't involve somebody else owning you in a kind of wage slavery. But it's something that has a wide appeal. And I think there's a real amnesia about a lot of these questions that we're talking about here. And it's not an accidental amnesia. It's not simply
right.
because we're ignorant.
Right.
I mean, anarchists have had a tremendous influence through American history, and especially the history of Europe and other places as well, along with other kinds of related political movements. But, anarchist labor organizers were incredibly influential in the earlier part of the 20th century, and they were ruthlessly suppressed. They were murdered, they were persecuted, they were imprisoned, they were exiled. Even at the questionnaire of like 30 questions that would be asked of anyone coming in to Ellis Island around the turn of the century, one of them was, "Are you an anarchist?" This was a really dangerous thing to be at that time. And yes, it's partly because this was associated with terrorism. There were some people who claimed to be anarchists who committed acts of terrorism
right.
at this time. But I think much, much, much more significantly was the fact that anarchists, along with others, were involved in organizing American workers and fighting for things like the 8-hour workday that so many of us enjoy today.
Yeah.
That was won through struggle that anarchists and socialists were involved in organizing. And so many of the labor protections and social safety net, the foundations of the social safety net that emerged during the Great Depression came through this kind of organizing. And after that, there was a ruthless campaign throughout the Cold War, during World War II as well, to suppress this kind of organizing, also to suppress the memory of it,
right.
to turn anarchist thought and socialist thought from a live political option that workers could consider when they're thinking about their place in their workplace, to just a kind of crass insult like we're seeing it used today.
Yeah, and my sense is, and I do want to go through some of the history, which is, as you say, it's intentionally been amnesia-fied, or if that's I can make up that word. My sense is that if people think of the word anarchist, and when the officials, screening the potential Americans coming in, asking about, oh, if you're an anarchist, my guess is that the image, the caricature, the stereotype of an anarchist does go back to the Haymarket bombing of, what was it, 1880, maybe 1886, something?
87,
where there was a bomb tossed and a number of police officers were killed during the Haymarket strike of 1886, 1887. And there was a lot of misinformation, to put it mildly, about who was responsible. And I'm not sure how well you may know your anarchist history, but I believe there was something like the Haymarket Eight that were all anarchists, and they were accused, and I think many of them even were hung, really for being anarchists, not necessarily for committing the crime. What, if anything, do you know about that?
Yeah, it's a common story that we've seen repeated a lot, where anarchists get pulled out of social movements and accused of being provocateurs, used to kind of discredit the movement. And those, I really encourage folks to look up those speeches from the Haymarket trials, because they're really remarkable speeches, and they on behalf of these anarchists, describing their view of the world, their view of society. This is not a bomb throwing view of society. It's a view of a future in which people can live as one family, where people can make decisions together, and where they can live in dignity. And this is really such a departure from what we normally hear. And a similar thing continues to happen today. I mean, in the Pacific Northwest right now, there have been, in the last couple of years, there have been grand juries opened up that particularly pick out anarchists. There's one happening right now in New York City, where I live, where anarchists are being picked up without trial and are being held if they don't cooperate with the grand jury, and essentially out, you know, their comrades. And it's very scary, the kind of persecution that goes on. You know, I just published a book about the Occupy movement. It's called Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse. And it explores, in a lot of ways, not exclusively, but the ways in which this movement was inspired by anarchist thought and anarchist practice. And once again here, we saw a case where law enforcement would identify people they thought of as anarchists or who called themselves anarchists, and they would target them, and they would blame them for things, and they would confront them with baseless accusations and try to split the movement internally, turn everyone else against the anarchists, and therefore cause the whole thing to fall apart. And in some ways, that was really successful over the last couple of years. And it's really a shame. I think it could be prevented if people understood a bit better what anarchists are talking about.
If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Nathan Schneider, who's written a lot about the subject of anarchism, what it is, what it isn't, and trying to address the realities of it, the fear. You know, that's the thing. When Franklin Roosevelt said that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, it was largely because fear can be manipulated and has been manipulated. And certainly the defendants in the Haymarket trial of 1887, that's probably a point at which the use of the fear of anarchists was really put in place. And I believe some of the members were hanged. There wasn't evidence particularly, but, oh, well, they were anarchists. What about, and I want to go through a little bit of the history that is really virtually unknown. The people listening may have heard the names Sacco and Vanzetti, or even Emma Goldman. I wonder if you could talk, Nathan, a little bit about the significance of such American anarchists as, was it Niccolo Vanzetti, and I can't remember Sacco's first name, something like that. Sacco and Vanzetti in the 1920s in Massachusetts, and of course Emma Goldman around the turn of the last century. Talk about the significance of those, if you would, please.
Absolutely. These are figures who, they're all immigrants from Europe. Sacco and Vanzetti were Italians, and Emma Goldman was Russian. And they came to the United States. I know Emma Goldman was really radicalized in the United States working in factories here. And they brought some of the radical ideas that were forming, taking shape in Europe, and they applied them to the American circumstance. Sacco and Vanzetti were ultimately executed for a crime that they insisted they didn't commit. But again, they were picked out for being anarchists. They came to be scapegoats for not only anti-anarchist sympathies in the public, but also anti-immigrant sympathies. That's something we're certainly familiar with today. And Emma Goldman was someone who articulated an anarchism that was really speaking to the kinds of profound labor abuses that were taking place in the Gilded Age in the U.S. when these robber barons were just running wild over over millions and millions of workers who were building our country yet had no power, no economic power in it. And she was part of movements that helped change that a little bit. But we're still in a moment where workers face incredible challenges. Immigrant workers often labor with no rights whatsoever, under the table. They have no protections. And even people who grew up in the U.S. more and more now are working without the protection of the union, without any job security, without any say in how their workplace operates. And, a large part of the reason for this slide is that we've forgotten the traditions and the institutions that have in the past helped workers protect themselves. We kind of take it for granted that workers are kind of peasants or indentured servants to their masters, and it's shocking. It's like reverse course.
Yeah, it is amazing how history has been forgotten and how people like Emma Goldman, what they talked about over 100 years ago, is still at issue today. For example, she was an advocate of birth control, which was terribly revolutionary and threatening to the male hierarchy. And nowadays, when you look at the whole reproductive rights situation, the most difficulty for reproductive rights organizations is reaching young women because they don't remember. The memory has been basically erased that it used to be the case that abortions simply were not legal and, people had to go to back alleys and dangerous situations. She talked about that. Another one of my favorite quotes, of course, from Emma Goldman is, "If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution." Love that.
And I think that points to something really important in America's thought, which is, as opposed to the kind of its kind of sister, philosophy on the left, Marxism of kind of state socialism, anarchism is really insistent on aligning the means and the ends, and creating. If you're going to create a revolution, do it in the way from the ground up where everything you do is a step toward that revolution and is about creating the kind of world that you want to see. Kind of like what Gandhi said, and Gandhi was influenced by a number of anarchist thinkers. He said, be the change you want to see in the world. And that's very much what anarchists are after. Rather than pursuing state power and using it to ruthlessly crush the owning class, as in the more Marxist approach, anarchists tend to want to build alternatives from the ground up, create spaces within the midst of capitalism that are non-capitalist, that teach people how to live in non-capitalist ways, teach people to live in more egalitarian ways, and then make those little bubbles spread. And we kind of saw that a bit in the Occupy movement, which I read about in my book, Thank You, Anarchy, where you've got these little bubbles appearing all over the country where people are practicing, are relating to each other in a very different way. And this is very much something that comes out of anarchist thought and is part of that anarchist approach to making change. You don't just focus on trying to transform the state now. You start from your life, your local situation, and you build out from there.
Yeah, and, we're so into just being cogs in the wheel, making money. It's all about making money. And I believe it's accurate to say that anarchists were some of the earliest voices calling for a recognition of, there's more to life than that. When she says, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution, it's about enjoying one another, having leisure time. And this is something that's even you and I talking about this now, we're ahead of our time, even though they were talking about it over 100 years ago, because people are recognizing, leisure is important, to have time with your friends, to have time with your family, to be able to be creative. And this is part of the essence of anarchist thought, correct?
Oh, that's a great point. It's just shocking that 100 years ago, people in the U.S. were working to get an eight-hour workday and actually we're still fighting that fight right now.
It's amazing.
And totally forgotten has been the aspiration that, oh, maybe by now in the future we would work 4 hours or even less a day. You know, if you look at any science fiction book from the 50s, you know, you see a world of the future around, you know, the 21st century where we work way, way less and we're able to enjoy the better things of life and put our energy and our creativity toward, you know, toward higher aspirations, toward things that really matter deeply to us.
Art,
and and since 1950, I just read that the average worker productivity in the United States has increased about 400%.
Oh my goodness.
Yet our the amount of hours that we work has almost not decreased at all. So where is all of that 400% of productivity going? Who is getting the wealth from that productivity? And why aren't we able to demand shorter working hours, a more livable wage, something to enable us to survive? This is being skimmed off the top. It's amazing.
And here we have, you know, in the dog-eat-dog world, to use yet another cliche, you know, there's a belief, an acceptance of the notion of scarcity, that we all have to, you know, if somebody else is making money, they're taking it away from me. It doesn't have to be the case. And when you talk about the 40-hour work week, I think one could say that the reality now is that if there were an average 30-hour work week, guess what? More people would be working. There'd be more to go around. People have a little more leisure time, and people wouldn't be in such desperate situations. We're talking about the history of anarchist thought here. It's not exactly what House Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Elizabeth Warren, much as I love Elizabeth Warren, and I do, they refer to the Republicans as the anarchy gang. Ain't necessarily so. For sure, there's a lot to anarchism. You talk, Nathan, a little bit about a horizontal structure. Going back a little bit in my own past, I was with the Clamshell Alliance in the late 70s in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, we were, again, ahead of our times being anti-nuclear. I mean, we were absolutely right that nuclear is an insane way to boil water. That's it. And it certainly is top down. I mean, it's very capital intensive. But anyway, Clamshell operated on a consensus model so that somebody could block consensus. It wasn't majority rule. It was absolutely required consensus. And as it turns out, it was kind of a self-defeating purism. And you know, purism often defeats really good movements. You have to be prepared to, you know, appreciate steps in the right direction. You know, I wonder about direct democracy, the consensus model, and I wonder, Nathan, what you think about, didn't a dogmatic adherence to consensus and horizontalism really cripple and doom the active, you know, street aspects of Occupy Wall Street? Wasn't that a problem, that horizontal decision making, that it's kind of unwieldy and impractical?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And, you know, first of all, I think, you know, you're so right to point out, point to your experience in the anti-nuclear movement. I mean, that was an incredible example of a very successful movement in this country that over the course of years was able to stop the construction of nuclear power plants,
yep,
shut down ones that existed already, and you know, we should all be very grateful for that. And that was a largely decentralized movement that operated in many cases under roughly anarchist principles. I think you're pointing to something really interesting here with the Occupy movement, and in this book, Thank You Anarchy, I document the way in which the process and the movement kind of broke down over the course of its first year. And a big part of it was that kind of purism. I would see it more as a kind of one-dimensionality or simplistic approach to what anarchist decision-making could look like. What happened was people really got excited with it at first. You know, when they experienced the general assemblies in the Occupy encampments, many people had never experienced something like that before. And they were just thrilled, and they were, they fell in love with it, really. That is really what it felt like and really what it seemed like when you're talking to folks getting involved there. But the problem was is they didn't have a lot of context for that. And if you talk to anybody who had been involved in the global justice movement a decade before, people who'd helped shut down the WTO meetings in Seattle in 1999, all of them from the very, very beginning at Occupy were saying, yeah, this General Assembly is nice, but pretty soon as this grows, we're going to have to build new structures that, you know, are a bit more flexible and so forth. But for the young folks who just got involved, because their history had been erased, because nobody had told them that 10 years earlier a structure called a Spokes Council had been used to shut down the WTO, to organize the protests that shut down the WTO. When a similar model like that arose in Occupy Wall Street, they rejected it and they reacted against it and they treated it like it was coming out of nowhere and that it was this kind of liberalizing force that was going to destroy the movement. And it was just kind of a shocking realization of that kind of amnesia that we've been talking about, the way in which they were unable to think their way toward a more kind of realistic, practical structure because they'd had so little experience and they'd been exposed to so little history of what has worked and what hasn't. And many anarchist organizations, for instance, like AK Press, an anarchist publisher, has done a lot of really wonderful writing and publishing about their internal process. And they don't use consensus. They use a kind of majority vote that aims toward consensus but doesn't quite reach it. And they found that that works really well for them. So if you look at many anarchist groups, even if they're really insistent on their anarchist principles, they often recognize that every group is different and you have to set up rules that suit its needs.
Yeah, and this whole amnesia. I had a professor in college who understood that when, the white Europeans came to what is now America, the idea was that we would get west of history. And it seems like, the whole thing in the 50s in particular, new and improved. You don't have to look at history. You can just do it from here on. It doesn't work. It's got its problems. You got to learn from history. I may have a lot of gray hair, but, I picked up a few things along the way in the late 60s when we learned what worked, what didn't work. There's a lot of theater that works really well. There's some other ideas that, frankly, don't work as well. We're talking about anarchism and the history of anarchism, and you've written that what was once the mainstream of libertarian thought, which is different, socialist, democratic anarchism, has become forgotten. And it seems to me that, Americans really have been intentionally de-educated about the importance of history. There are powers that don't want us to learn our history, that want us to have historical amnesia. Why might that be? Any suggestions as to who or what interests benefit from historical amnesia?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's just the normal, it's the usual suspects. It's the corporate rulers. It's the political leaders. Who's talking about anarchists now? It's even leaders of the Democratic Party. Someone like Elizabeth Warren is tossing around anarchist as as an insult right now.
Right.
This was somebody who was elected on the heels of a populist movement, the Occupy movement, that was driven by anarchism. It's amazing. But once you get into that kind of position of power, once you start seeing the structure of the world that way as being one full of corporate donations and government regulations, then you see anarchism as something very dangerous, rightly so, and you want to dismiss it at every turn. And this history has been, profoundly, profoundly ignored. Another part of it that we haven't talked about yet is actually the way I first got exposed to anarchism personally.
I was going to ask.
Religious anarchism there's a long tradition of Christian anarchism, for instance, and anarchism in other religious traditions as well. One of the earliest anarchist texts comes out of China, associated with Taoism. And someone like Dorothy Day, who now is it may be canonized by the Catholic Church.
You
know, considered herself a Christian anarchist, yet you're not going to hear Cardinal Dolan talking about that. You're not going to see this tradition taken seriously the way it really deserves to be.
And in an article you wrote, you mentioned that the original Zionism, which nowadays people see as kind of this, you know, racist, oppressive, militaristic state of Israel, but that the original Zionism actually had a lot of anarchism in it. It was far different from the Zionism that we see today. I wonder if you could explain that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And for that, I really recommend looking at this new collection of Noam Chomsky's writings on anarchism that the New Press is publishing. And I did a little introduction for that called Anarchist Amnesia about this whole question. And in that book, in the essays collected in that book, you hear a lot from Chomsky. It kind of feels like, you know, it feels like coming from another time. You know, he grew up in New York City around just before World War II, and he saw a kind of Zionism, a kind of worker organizing, socialism that we just don't have access to anymore. And he was a part of the early Zionist movement, early right after the formation of the State of Israel, and was supportive of it because he saw an experiment in grassroots agrarian communal living where people were sharing things in common, even raising their children together.
Yes.
And very different from what we're seeing now, which is a much more kind of imperial state power military driven Zionism, and the difference couldn't be more dramatic.
Yeah, for sure. But the voluntary joining together, egalitarian, and again, raising children as a community, powerful idea, and it seemed to work for a while. And you mentioned earlier the anarchist tradition back in the Spanish Civil War, a favorite subject of mine, as my longtime listeners can tell you. In Homage to Catalonia, George Orwell wrote about the anarchist town in Spain, the town of Aragon. There was something in there that showed the essence of the anarchist vision in Orwell's writing about Homage to Catalonia. Could you talk about that a little bit, about the Orwell showing the essence of the anarchist vision?
Oh, yeah. It's really astonishing. I mean, as I was working on the introduction to the book of writings on Chomsky, in which he talks about the Spanish Civil War a lot, it was just striking to me how much Orwell sounded like people writing about the Occupy movement. You know, and they were describing what was so exciting, so inspiring, as a whole city was, seemed to have eliminated hierarchies, where nobody was trying to look richer than anybody else. Yeah. Everyone was kind of playing humble and treating one another as equals, and it was an entirely different way of being. But what was so shocking was that this was not just one little square block in the middle of a city like the Occupy occupations were.
Right.
This was an entire region that was influenced by this movement, and that was where workers in cities and farmers in the countryside were all reorganizing their economic relations according to these lines. And this had been this wasn't just spontaneous. This had been building for years and years and years through various anarchist and socialist movements. What Chomsky so nimbly describes in one of these chapters is the way in which that history has just been erased, even by liberal historians. They've very carefully tucked it away and dismissed it, when in fact it was a very, very real, visceral phenomenon, as anybody who's read Homage to Catalonia knows.
Again, we're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with Nathan Schneider, who has written a new book called, what is the name of the book there?
Thank You, Anarchy, Notes from the Occupy Apocalypse.
And we're talking about what anarchy and anarchism really is. It's not, well, it has been used lately as a slur against those radical right-wing Republicans who are holding the country hostage. I wonder if you could, you know, people do seem to confuse even libertarians, I think. You know, it kind of gets mixed together and blurry. Libertarianism and anarchism. There's certainly a similar disdain for excessive authoritarianism and centralization and concentration of power and wealth. And I wonder about, you know, if you could do a little comparison of libertarianism and anarchism, and maybe even speak to the hope, perhaps, that right and left wing anarchists, libertarians, might actually get together to form a powerful new coalition which is against such things as NSA spying and militarism and, you know, the concentration of wealth and power in fewer and fewer hands.
Yeah, it's a really interesting challenge. You know, we live in a country where right now actually libertarian ideas, you know, small L libertarian, broad-based libertarian, the tradition that includes both Ron Paul and, you know, an anarchist like David Graeber, is really on the rise, and where a lot of young people are really activated by libertarian ideas, by the idea of a more kind of locally driven, self-sustaining society built on human responsibility rather than government and corporate oversight. And the problem is that the kind of libertarianism that is by far the most available in this country, that is really funded and promoted, and you know, we hear from it every time there's a Republican debate, and you know, it's very much a presence in our discourse, is this kind of right libertarianism, which takes the tradition of anarchist and libertarian thought and applies it only to government. So they're very, very concerned about the overreach of government, and they're very concerned about, you know, the impositions on states' rights, but they're not concerned about a whole host of other kinds of oppression. They're not as concerned about militarism. They're not as concerned about police violence. So in some ways, they're some of the better critics on those issues. They're especially not concerned about corporate power,
right.
And that's, I think, largely because they've been so well-funded by corporate power. I think in the grassroots manifestations, that it's very different. There's a lot of suspicion about corporate power.
For sure.
You know, anarchists, on the other hand, are concerned with a whole range of forms of oppression, and, you know, are concerned about... you know, they recognize that the real driving force in our political system right now is that corporate power,
right.
Is that corporate money and that profit motive that is overriding, has so completely overridden our any claim we have to be a democracy.
Yeah, I know.
But there are points of agreement which you've pointed to, and one is definitely this concern with NSA spying, with all kinds of surveillance, with the overreach of the police state. You know, also with militarism abroad. And, you know, I've been wondering more and more whether if more young people today who are considering themselves kind of right libertarians were exposed to this broader anarchist tradition, they might be even more attracted to it and see more of their ideals manifested in it. But I think they're just, you know, what they're limited to is so, or what they're exposed to is
right.
So limited, it's a shame.
Yeah, again, keeping people from knowledge, because knowledge obviously is a very, very powerful thing. And again, looking at history, as you point out, both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution claimed the basic equality of all humans. How in keeping is anarchism with at least some of the very diverse traditional American values? I mean, people don't know about this.
Oh yeah, it's a very interesting story, and there are ways in which Thomas Jefferson's thought, for instance, is very anarchist, is very you know, much leaning toward vesting power in local communities and fearing the centralization of power. You know, even that word that we comes from that period for us, federalism, federation. You know, that's actually a word used in anarchist thought a great deal. Is this recognition that, you know, ultimately you're going to have some kind of organization
right.
and structure.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, if you really organize as efficiently as possible, as democratically as possible, you're going to have federated structures. you know, where truly as much power as possible lies in the local communities, and only the powers that are necessary lie in the larger bodies. And so that's very much an anarchist thought. But there are also really crucial differences. And, you know, one thing that I think is really, really stands out between those who consider themselves anarchists today and those who lean more on the libertarian side is that anarchists tend to really have very little romantic feeling about the United States of America, especially now in our globalizing moment. You know, they see their role as being global actors, as being global citizens. They're interested often in eradicating borders, you know, in really embracing the way in which our world is a global community and in thinking globally. And the Occupy movement was a great example of that. You know, so many of the organizers who participated in that, especially the earliest ones who I reported on in the book Thank You Anarchy, were people who had been traveling around the world to different movements and just saw themselves as trying to not start an American movement that was better than all the other movements, which would be a kind of typical American attitude, but to just join the movement that the rest of the world was already doing and finally step up to the plate, you know, stop sitting on the sidelines. And that's a really important difference. And I think there are ways in which we've really outgrown the kind of jingoism that often goes with how we view the Constitution, that this is the greatest document in the world. I mean, when we invade a country and replace its government, we don't even give it anything like our system. It's shocking that we seem to be so committed to it in all these ways. And I think it's time for a much broader conversation about what self-organization, what political organization should look like in a globalizing world where everything we do affects everyone else.
Boy, you can see why the powers that be are so threatened by this idea. I mean, it really is a threat to that, you know, the whole notion of American exceptionalism, that we're better than everybody else, and that, you know, there has to be this. I mean, libertarianism amazingly includes the sort of Ayn Rand kind of thing that let the big and powerful corporations do whatever they want. And, you know, that's, I don't think, in keeping with the anarchist tradition. And again, we're talking with Nathan Schneider about anarchism. He's the author of the new book, Thank You, Anarchy. One of my favorite quotes from the May 1968 student worker uprising in France, which was a very heady time. There was some graffiti that said, "Be realistic, demand the impossible." And, you know, I wonder, anarchism probably is not going to actually happen, but I wonder, you know, what positive historical effects have there been and will continue? And I guess we've already answered some of that, you know, calling for recognition of people's rights, Universal Declaration of Human Rights that that Eleanor Roosevelt pushed through. But, you know, if it's not going to happen, and Noam Chomsky, one of the greats, argues it's completely realistic and rational to work within structures to which you are opposed. What about that and the use of anarchism and what Noam Chomsky argues, which in a way seems like a contradiction in terms?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great question. And to start answering it, I think I would point listeners to a book that actually takes its title from the quotation of May 68 that you mentioned. It's a book called Demanding the Impossible by Peter Marshall, and it's published by PM Press. And it's a really fantastic introduction to the intellectual tradition of anarchism. It's much less about the kind of practical, but it's about this long intellectual tradition that I've been talking about. It's a fantastic book. It's pretty hefty, but it gives you a sense of what a rich tradition this really is. As far as what we can expect and what we can work for now, I think it's really important to just start locally, to look right in front of us,
right,
and to look at what our real needs are in our communities, to kind of clear the slate from the things that our politicians tell us we should be deciding between. You know, right now we're being told that we're in the middle of a crisis with this shutdown. Is that really the crisis that we're in? This was a manufactured crisis. Absolutely. By the very people who are now unable to solve it. So, you know, why is this our crisis? Why isn't the fact that we have more people in prison in this country than any other country in the world, including China, why is that not a crisis? Why is the fact that we're spending more money on the military than any other country in the world combined,
right,
not a crisis? You know, these are the real crises that we're facing. Why is it that we're the only developed country in the world without a universal health care system, practically?
Amazing.
You know, that's a crisis. And I think, you know, thinking of anarchist thought inclines us to kind of wipe away what these politicians are telling us we should be caring about and really focusing on what's before us. What are the real challenges that we're confronting? And how can we build power from the ground up, build power in our communities, you know, build conversations in our communities, eviscerate the alienation that has been kind of imposed on us through capitalist structures whereby we don't really get together and talk about what we want. We kind of occasionally see one another and to pass the time, we talk about what the politicians are talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real radical reorientation about what politics really is. It's something that starts from us. And I think when we do that, if we start organizing in our workplaces and in our neighborhoods, even if the state doesn't disappear immediately, which it probably won't,
right,
it will have to listen. And that's why anarchists have been so dangerous through time, because they know how to organize people. And when people are organized, those in power have to listen. They have no choice. People are too powerful for them.
And, of course, you remind me of a great conversation between Franklin Roosevelt and A. Philip Randolph, who was the leader of the International Brotherhood of Pullman Car Workers, which was largely a black association, people working on the trains. And he was trying to, Randolph was trying to convince Roosevelt to do something about equality and fairness. And Roosevelt said, I don't know the exact quote, that he agreed with Randolph, and he told Randolph, no, go out there. Now go out there and make me do it. And I think that's what we're talking
about. I heard something similar once from a historian from Norway. Really, you know, we think of the Norwegians as having this very, very powerful, you know, welfare state where you know, everyone's kind of taken care of and their health care is free and everything's free and, you know, and we think of it as a very kind of strong socialist state. But, you know, I asked this historian, how did you get there? What's the most important thing to you that led to that kind of very people-centered economy?
Right.
And she said, she started talking about the 17th, 18th century pietists, which was amazing. These were religious groups, Protestant religious groups, that were basically separatists. And they went off into their little communities, and they organized for themselves. They provided for themselves. They created an ethic where everyone would be taken care of in their community. And that built power from the ground up. And it made it so, as the state developed, it had to, in a way, kind of compete with those local forces.
Uh-huh. Oh, interesting. Well, this has been fascinating. Nathan Schneider, his new book is Thank You, Anarchy, also editor at Killing the Buddha, and the website is theroboat.com. Thank you so much. Very, very interesting. It's good to look at real history and try to fight against the amnesia. Thank you, Nathan.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
And let's see if we can get together.
Here I see Lawless, he is dangerous, dirty, violent.